Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today is our national vaccine regime. And debunking the arguments behind mandatory vaccination and the removal of religious and philosophical exemptions, we're going to have three panelists. First, we're going to have Dr. Kelly Sutton. She's a medical doctor, and she's going to be joined with Barbara Lowe Fisher, who's the president of the National Vaccine Information Center, and also Professor Mary Holland. She is the vice chair of the board for the Children's Health Defense, founded by Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. She's also a scholar at the New York Area Law School, specializing in international human rights, public law, and vaccine safety law, and injury compensation. She is also a woman with a son who regressed into autism following the MMR vaccine. Mary holds a degree in Russian studies from Harvard University and graduated with degrees in international relations and a JD from Columbia University. She is the co-author of Vaccine Epidemic, about corporate greed and bad science behind the vaccine industry. And her most recent book is The HPV Vaccine Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. It is the most concise book behind the history and adverse effects of the human papilloma vaccine, such as Gardasil, with a preface from the Nobel Prize winning in medicine, Dr. Luc Montagnier. Also, Dr. Kelly Sutton was trained in internal medicine and pediatrics and has practiced for over 40 years. Her clinical practice incorporates principles of anthroposophic medicine founded by Rudolf Steiner. And it's a natural, non-toxic approach for prevention and treatment of acute and chronic illnesses. She also operates an online library of anthroposophic medical treatments at SophieMichaelRemedies.com. And since 2015, after California eliminated non-medical vaccine exemptions, she's been providing medical evaluation for children and adults at risk of vaccine injury. Dr. Sutton currently divides her practice between Fair Oaks, California, and Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her website is RaphaelMedicine.com. And Barbara Lowe Fisher, to complete her bio, she's written several books, very important books, on vaccines and vaccine policies, including Reforming Vaccine Policy and Law, a guide. In 1986, Barbara worked with Congress to assure there were vaccine safety provisions in the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, and is a member of the Consumers United for Evidence-Based Healthcare and the Cochrane Collaboration. She has also testified on behalf of vaccine safety in Congress and several state legislative bodies. And she's written for numerous publications and operates a vaccine news site, thevaccinereaction.org. Her organization's website is nvic.org. Nice to have you all with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to begin with you, Barbara. And then after you, we're going to have Professor Mary Holland and then Dr. Kelly Sutton each address from your own perspectives the same issue. And that's important because we're mainly going to focus on debunking the arguments used to create the vaccine regime we are entering into right now. And this is less about questions of safety and efficacy because there is utter denial of that. And they constantly argue that there's a scientific consensus on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So we'd like to explore some other issues, and I invited each of you because of your unique position on this. So Barbara, now with both New York and California passing bills to remove all non-medical exemptions for vaccines, we will be seeing these same kinds of bills being steamrolled through the other states' legislative bodies. There's a lot of power, a lot of money, public relations firms, lobbyists behind this in all 50 states. And as we all know, the outbreaks of measles has been a major contributing factor behind the aggressive efforts to remove religious and philosophical exemption laws. Repeatedly, the media, including unshamefully so its medical doctors, make some kind of reference to these measles outbreaks as an excuse to support these bills. And yet the main argument being given is that unvaccinated people, largely children, are to be blamed for these recent outbreaks. But the science does not support that. Richard Gale and myself, as you know, have published in just the last year and a half 56 articles, all fully referenced, on the subject of vaccines. And our latest one shows that, first off, an awful lot of the children getting the infection, and it's not a disease, it's an infection of measles, were already vaccinated. And then we saw that there were another group of people, a large group of people who received the vaccine for measles, the MMR vaccine, and came down with measles from the vaccine. So no one in science can accurately and honestly say all these cases of the measles were due to unvaccinated children and their irresponsible parents. And that's the picture they're painting. Also, quite simply, we took a look at the history of measles and found that in the last 20 years, in a population of somewhere between 327 million and 330 million citizens, we've only had 2 deaths from measles. Now compare that to anything else in medicine, and you will not see anything that disproves their argument. But at the same time, we have over 422 deaths reported from the measles vaccine and tens of thousands of injuries. So I'm concerned that physicians, pharmacists, nurses, our legislators, state and federal, and the heads of all of our federal agencies, including the CDC and FDA, are refusing to start where any qualified researcher would. Look at the evidence and tell us, where does it take you? So what do we know now from the scientific literature and from health records that indicate outbreaks can occur irrespective of what percentage of people are unvaccinated or no longer have immunity to a given infectious disease? The forum is yours. Take your time.
So are you asking me whether the evidence shows that you can be vaccinated and still transmit wild-type measles or vaccine-strain measles? Is that where we're beginning?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, certainly, like you, I also did a special report on measles at the end of May and went back into the history of measles in this country. And it's very clear that they knew when they developed the measles vaccine that measles was what they themselves described as a very mild illness compared to something like smallpox. But nevertheless, they decided they were going to eradicate by the widespread use of a vaccine. But I think what a lot of people don't understand is that you can get vaccinated for, use MMR vaccine, you can use pertussis vaccine, and that's both the whole cell pertussis DPT vaccine and the acellular version that we use now. You can use influenza vaccine, and you can still get infected with the wild type pertussis or with wild-type measles, and you can exhibit few or no symptoms, and you can transmit. So you can be vaccinated, fully vaccinated, still get infected with wild-type measles, and transmit sometimes with few or no symptoms. That means that those people who are doing that are not being identified. They're not being reported. Who's being reported? Those people who are unvaccinated and who are fully expressing the symptoms of measles. So it looks as if only those who are unvaccinated are getting measles, when that's not the truth. Both unvaccinated and vaccinated people are getting measles. We do not know to the extent that measles is circulating in our population or in other populations. So I think that when you look at herd immunity has always been really a combination, certainly since we've been using vaccines, vaccine-acquired as well as wild-type acquired immunity. You can be vaccinated, and you can be asymptomatically boosted by coming in contact with the wild-type virus. They're not talking about this in public. They don't want people to talk about it. They don't want people to think about it. But I think that really when we look at vaccine policy in this country, whether or not we talk about the science, I think the most important thing is that this is about civil liberties. This is about the right to autonomy, the right to freedom of thought and speech and conscience and religious belief. And that certainly is coming down to the politics of vaccination. The science is going to be debated for years, years and years. But are we as a country going to have the freedom to be able to protect bodily integrity, our bodily integrity, that of minor children, our minor children? Or are we going to have that freedom taken from us by medical doctors and public health officials who develop government policy and then tell us that we may not depart from that policy? Certainly, this is being played out in all of the states right now. This year, we saw more than 150 bills, vaccine-related bills introduced into state legislatures. 30 of those states were looking at whether or not to eliminate, restrict, or expand vaccine exemptions. NVIC supported 50 of the bills, which was a record number of bills that were proposing to expand or protect informed consent rights. But what happened this year? Well, the vaccine lobby, the forced vaccination lobby, is composed of the medical establishment, the government health agencies, and the pharmaceutical companies. Very powerful lobby. And they managed to get the religious exemption in New York removed. They managed to get it, the conscience and religious exemption removed in Maine. And in Washington, the legislature decided to restrict or to eliminate religious belief exemption for MMR vaccine only. So that, in a way, was a semi-victory for parents who, because the legislators wanted to eliminate it for all vaccines, and they only restricted it to MMR vaccine. We managed, the parents organized and managed to protect the religious exemption or conscience exemption in Colorado, in Oregon, in Washington, in Arizona, in Alabama, in Missouri. So the people are standing up. But when you have something happen like you did in New York, where you had in one day, with no public hearings, a bill rammed through that legislature, both houses, and had the governor sign it on the same day, when you have that kind of a powerful lobby managing to pull that off in the fourth largest state in the union, you know, we can anticipate that there is going to be a huge effort in the next few years to have the rest of the states follow the lead of New York, which was, of course, begun in 2015 with California eliminating the personal belief exemption. And what they're going to try to do is have medical exemptions be restricted to CDC contraindications only. If you look at the CDC contraindications, almost nothing qualifies as a reason to exempt a child or an adult from vaccination. You can have HIV, you are a candidate for vaccination. You can have cancer. If you're through chemotherapy, you're a candidate for vaccination. Certainly children who have regressed after vaccination are not, in the view of the CDC, in most cases, are not a candidate for a medical exemption. That means if you eliminate the personal belief exemptions in the states and you only leave medical, and that medical is restricted to the CDC contraindications, you have forced vaccination in this country, no liability as of 2011, even for design defect. You have nobody held accountable in a civil court, not anybody who makes the vaccine, profits from it, who votes to mandate it, anybody who gives it. It is the parents and the children and the people who are at the mercy of this forced vaccination lobby who are going to pay the price for these kinds of oppressive laws.
I appreciate your opening statement. I will offer you one follow-up, and each of the other panelists, they'll have that same opportunity. The Washington Post had an editorial about the irresponsible nature of parents who decide not to vaccinate. And they were suggesting that these parents should be, in effect, shamed, even arrested, even imprisoned. Now we're hearing this around the United States. We're hearing in California that where a lot of parents have taken their children out of regular public school because they didn't want to vaccinate, they were fearful. And these tended to be parents who had done homework, who had empowered themselves. In fact, one of the women I interviewed, a medical doctor, a pediatrician, her first child she vaccinated, and the child died. And she had given the vaccine. And she said she had to live with that. So with her second child, she chose not to vaccinate. So how can you take someone, and she said she's done thousands of hours of research, and she was appalled by all the evidence of how toxic the ingredients were. She was reading the toxicological journals, which are almost never cited in the pro-vaccine arguments. And she said the women in her circle, and these were all women whose children had been injured or killed because of the vaccines, including Gardasil, they had more knowledge because of their determination to find the truth than their physicians. So what does it say when the government, the major media, and the private industry groups now are starting to attack women, including educated women who have been victims, and yet at the same time, and I agree, we should support women who have been victimized in any other area of life and support them, and yet we're saying, no, we're not supporting any woman, no matter what her rationale for not vaccinating. That person is now denigrated and attacked. Your thoughts, please.
Well, the right to autonomy and protection of bodily integrity is the first human right. If you can't voluntarily decide when and for what reason you're willing to risk your life or your life of your child, your unalienable right to life and liberty has been taken from you. And whether or not listeners of this show agree that every liability-free vaccine product sold by pharmaceutical companies is safe and effective, and they want to follow the vaccine schedule, what they need to think about is that the laws that are being changed today that prevent us from making voluntary decisions about the use of a pharmaceutical product that can carry that carries a risk of injury or death, these laws are going to govern us when the new vaccines that are coming, vaccines that are being made in ways that people haven't even dreamed of. We think it's bad today. Just wait until we see the vaccines and how they're being made and how they're going to change our DNA, how they're going to change our immune systems, and how our immune systems and brains function. I mean, people need to understand this is a civil liberties issue. And we all need to stand up and fight for the right to the human right to informed consent to medical risk taking, no matter what the product is, no matter what the medical intervention is.
Thank you for that additional comment. And by the way, just to finish my thought, the parents in California who are choosing to homeschool instead of put their children at risk from any adverse effects from vaccines, now Dr. Pan and others are creating laws that would prevent even homeschooling, in which case then it throws a family into chaos, their careers, their family, their investments. Possibly they can't even afford to move, and now they're weighing, should I put my child at risk or should we move? And that's a serious situation. Professor Hollum, would you pick up and address the same two issues, please?
Sure. So I heartily endorse all of the things that Barbara Lowe Fisher has said. I think this is absolutely a civil liberties issue, as well as still being a medical and scientific issue. And I want to pick up on your thread, Gary, about this being sort of the changing role of doctors. And what's happening in California in particular is to make the state be able to second guess every medical decision of a doctor when it comes to vaccines. They really are changing the role of doctors to being medical police. Doctors are now agents of the state, and they are accountable to the state, not to the patient. So there's a complete betrayal of a doctor-patient relationship. The other thing is, I think you honed in on this idea of misogyny. it is, for the most part, it's parents who are protecting children, but overwhelmingly these are mothers protecting their infants. The name of our species, mammals, comes from the mother-child relationship. What these laws are doing is literally destroying that mother-infant relationship, and it's destroying families, as you point out. I've been reading affidavits of families who are contesting this religious exemption repeal in New York, and, you know, families are looking at homeschooling and moving out of states. It's putting them under financial pressure. Parents are not able to work. They're not able to care for their aged relatives. Children are having anxiety attacks. Children are having to go to therapists. It's putting stress on marriages. I mean, this has just been done in this extraordinarily barbaric way. And when I think of this, you know, we all understand that segregation in education was blasphemous. It was a terrible stain on America's civil liberties. We're now talking about these children can't go to any school. So I like Barbara's term of the forced vaccination lobby. That's what this is, and that's what we're up against. I can certainly tell you that, you know, as in California, in New York, you know, people are not taking this lying down. Not only are they protesting and writing letters and lobbying and going to see their representatives, but there's already been one lawsuit filed in New York contesting the repeal of the religious exemption, saying that this was based in animus against religion, and that the government must act in a neutral manner with respect to religions. And so what they showed was hostility to religion itself, and it's caused irreparable harm. And there are many other avenues by which the law in New York is going to be challenged. So, but as Barbara points out, you know, if they can take this, if they can do this in New York and California, it's kind of filling in the squares. You know, if they get away with this in New York, this forced vaccination lobby, certainly every other state is at risk. And it's worth pointing out, this is not just in the United States. This is a global effort by the pharmaceutical industry. You know, the U.S. is obviously key. This is a big medical market, but this is happening in Italy. It's happening, you know, in Poland. It's happening in countries around the world.
Thank you for that opening statement. I have a follow-up question for you specifically. I am contending that behind a lot of what we're seeing in the official mandates are an insensitivity to racial issues, and one could, I believe, reasonably argue that the CDC, carrying forward with this Tuskegee experiment, where several hundred people, African-Americans, who had syphilis were not treated for over 40 years, and then they spread it exponentially throughout the African-American community, that they are also engaging this because the CDC's own vaccinologist, Dr. William Thompson, and I've heard his actual voice when he was speaking with Dr. Brian Hooker, a California scientist whose own son was vaccine injured and was seeking Freedom of Information Act documents from the CDC. And lo and behold, Dr. Thompson, in a very unusual move, called him. And they had conversations, but then they struck up this conversation on an ongoing basis. And then at one of these conversations, Dr. Thompson revealed, to his shame, that the CDC and all of its vaccine scientists were fully aware that a 2002 study showed that there was a 324% increase in autism spectrum disorder in African-American boys 36 months and younger. And this caused such a panic, they met, and Thompson said that they decided to destroy the information. So they brought black garbage bags into the office and threw all of it away, and it was to be destroyed. He was fearful that he may be asked one day to testify before Congress and end up in trouble because he, in effect, he obstructed justice. He destroyed evidence. So he kept a copy. Now, not one single time has he been allowed to testify before Congress or the American public, nor have you seen a single journalist from any publication, the Washington Post, which is right near there, the National Institutes of Health, and in Atlanta, you have the Atlanta Journal, New York, the New York Times. Not a single journalist has said, let us demand that Dr. Thompson and all of those CDC employees who knew the truth that African-American boys were at a higher risk of autism spectrum disorder and hid this information, and there's been no consequence to anyone, and yet when we're talking about vaccine safety and efficacy, the Vera Stratton study showed similar results, and this is an actual cover-up, and yet you can't sue them. There's an immunity. So not only are we immunizing the vaccine makers, but we're also immunizing, in effect, the scientists working for governmental agencies who know the truth and now are not allowed to say it publicly. And there's a Florida legislator who's been trying to get any committee in Congress that he can to hold hearings, and no hearings are being allowed. And you know the kind of pressures coming from behind the scenes, the pharmaceutical industry and its lobbyists, to say, no hearings, don't touch this. Your thoughts on this?
Well, that's all absolutely correct. I guess I was going to say, I certainly think that, you know, vaccines, we don't know in advance how any given individual is going to react, but we certainly see with the data you're talking about and other data that certain vaccines can be more harmful to particular groups. There can be more adverse events in that group. And I was very happy to see, I was at the New York State Legislature when they repealed the exemption. I wasn't happy about that, but I was very happy that in the Health Committee, there were two African-American Democrat assembly people who spoke out in the committee, and they spoke out again on the floor of the assembly. And one of them, Representative Assembly Member Barron, specifically talked about Tuskegee and how it's essential that bodily integrity is so fundamental, and this decision has to be left to the parents. And the other African-American assembly person was a young woman representing Brooklyn named Assemblywoman Bichotte, and she's of Haitian-American background, and she specifically referenced the discrimination against Haitians based on the fear of their being carriers of AIDS and how discriminatory it was. And she pointed also to the financial incentives here for universal vaccination, forced vaccination. So I was happy to see that African-American representatives were really carrying this torch. And I believe there's a lot of work to be done in reaching out to a lot of communities, religious communities and to minority communities, to women's communities, to educate them more on the reality of vaccine injury. As you point out, I mean, we've all been subject to a kind of propaganda and brainwashing. Vaccines are safe and effective. Vaccines save lives. That has an impact. It has an effect. People are not being told about adverse effects. They're not being told about the, you know, the burgeoning science about the role of aluminum. They're not being told that vaccines cause autism. They're not being told any of that. So it's not so surprising that it's very hard for us to get through to people, but I do think there are audiences who don't trust the government, who know that the CDC and U.S. federal health agencies have done absolutely unethical experiments and treatment decisions in the past. So in some respects, that was hopeful to me.
Thank you. I appreciate your input. And now over to you, Dr. Kelly Sutton. Please address the larger issue, then I have a specific question for you as a follow-up.
Always been as an authority, and over time that authoritarian relationship with patients became more equalized, and there was even a tendency towards making individualized medical decisions and using the many new kinds of testing, including genetics, to understand individual strengths and weaknesses. So The shift away from a profession to becoming an agent of the state is a sea change for doctors. And I hope that California doesn't complete its passing of SB 276. Doctors have been placed under the burden of fear of losing their license and threatened to speak with one voice. As an exempting physician in California, I have had doctors send patients to me because they did not want to write medical exemptions from vaccines for fear of their license. And I think the public has been placed under the fear of germs by the single voice of the media. So we don't have a very diverse source to feed our thinking. We have conformity in the media, conformity in the medical profession, and with that much conformity, there's not a real foundation for being able to analyze what's happening. Parents are taught not to trust their own instincts, but to trust the doctor, and learn too often in a hard way the results of the vaccines. That's where these wonderful, strong voices of parents come from today, is parents who have learned firsthand the impact of vaccines in their own families.
Lawrence Livermore is a highly respected institution where they do a lot of original and applied research, basic and applied. And it was found that the parents there, especially the women, many of whom have PhDs, and they're scientists, were the least likely to vaccinate because they had done their homework and had concerns. And so instead of bringing these women and their partners onto public forums and say, okay, here's a pro-vaccine advocate, Dr. Paul Offit. He says you could inject 10,000 vaccines into a child, nothing bad is going to happen. And so why should you be an exception? Doesn't it set a bad precedent? And they're not allowing these individuals, these parents, to give their statements of what they have found in the scientific literature, nor are they allowing Dr. Sherry Timpany, Dr. Nancy Banks, and Dr. Tony Bart and others to come forward and to have open debates so the public can hear both sides and decide which, if either, they would support. Also, Facebook and Google are cleansing any anti-vaccine comments, and instead of and they've tried to use a pejorative in a mockish way by suggesting that if a person chooses not to vaccinate, they're anti-vaccine, which is not true. In fact, even the physicians who are challenging vaccines still want and believe that there should be good science with a pure, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial where the placebo is not another vaccine, and that's what they've been using, but rather a saline solution. And you cross-match two groups, and you give it to the children, and then you follow them every 6 months over a period of 3 to 5 years, and then you do something that's never been done. You actually had some proof. So what we have is propaganda instead of real good proof. So when this case came up in California, before it was legislated, I looked into the backgrounds of every single one of the people who was going to say yes to mandatory vaccines, and we managed to find the amount of money they had received, every single one who voted for it, from the pharmaceutical company, including the pharmaceutical company, for the vaccines that were going to be mandated. And when we went to present this, nobody would allow us on the air. Not even Pacifica's KPFA. They censored Bonnie Faulkner and I for making this original presentation, which could have helped. I also had collected over 1,000 peer-reviewed journals from PubMed showing the toxicity of aluminum as an adjuvant, polysorbate 80, formaldehyde, and in those vaccines still using mercury and ethyl mercury, the documents there. And that was not all of the science, that was just 1,000 studies. So when they say it's safe, I'm saying prove it. The Supreme Court said that they're unavoidably unsafe. So as a physician in California, I have read that you have been targeted. You're under investigation. You're being attacked. They already went after Dr. Ken Stoller, and he is a brilliant pediatrician. And they're going after every single doctor who wants to stand up for the sovereignty of a woman's right to know what goes into her body and say yes or no to it, irrespective of her overall views on vaccination in general. Your thoughts on this, please.
Thank you. Yes, there seemed to be a need in California to create a very elegant argument to make the law work, because in 2011, the only way 277 would have passed is if doctors were absolutely guaranteed the right to write medical exemptions. It was dead in the water if that had not been approved. So now doctors had to be attacked, and the statements have been made that the bad apples are making a quick buck and writing fraudulent exemptions. And as a result, the bill currently would go forward saying that a doctor can only write an exemption on pain of perjury, can only write 4 per year, and the 5th exemption in a 12-month period would trigger a review of all exemptions, and if anything faulty, not in alignment with the CDC guidelines, is found, then that individual would, at a minimum, not be able to write for 2 years any exemptions and may be subjected to California Medical Board discipline. So these very punitive things against physicians are not characteristic of what has been written for West Virginia and Mississippi, where I think there's like a $25 to $100 fine for a doctor if they write an exemption that doesn't pass muster with the Department of Public Health. So it's a remarkably punitive law in California that seemed to have to create this case with the media in order to be shifting public opinion, because public opinion was very much 4 years ago in favor of the doctor-patient relationship. So now the badness of doctors has to be proven by periodic, almost monthly media attacks on different doctors, Dr. Sears, Dr. Stoller, a group of doctors of whom I'm one. And it seems to be the way that the politics is working with media to get the law passed in California, which it still has not accomplished.
Thank you for that insight. Barbara, back to you. You may have seen the article that we published earlier this week attacking a recent Scientific America essay written by the magazine's editors. So it wasn't just one writer. That's their official policy now, and there is nothing particularly new in the article. We've heard its arguments numerous times over the years, but one statement goes to the heart of the crisis we're facing. And the editor wrote, quote, "We need to consider the needs of the herd over the individual," end quote. And this would have been found in a lot of earlier places in the world where you as an individual don't matter. What is good for the larger group? And my God, that reeks of something out of Mussolini's fascist movement in the 1920s, even Hitler's movement in the earlier 1930s. And it's, to me, it's very concerning that you're not allowing a person to know the full story about what's mandated, nor are you making your presentation essential. So, in fact, the great mathematician and Nobel Prize winner Bertrand Russell warned about when he wrote that science at its worst would be a threat to democracy and bring about the collapse of civilization. He believed science had no role in authoritarian government, but accepted vaccine science seems to be headed in that direction. So how do we address these images that the herd's needs are greater than the individual, and yet I've studied the science extensively, and I can't find any legitimate science that is independent that supports the herd versus the individual. Your thoughts, please.
Well, yes, we're getting to the heart of it. In 2015, I called this the vaccine culture war and placed it at the center of a larger culture war that's going on, not just in this country, but really around the world. And that, again, comes down to whether or not the individual is going to have autonomy and have the freedom to make decisions, particularly decisions which directly affect physical health, mental health. It's about freedom. Or is the state or either the government or a world government going to have the power to tell you what you can do with your body and the bodies of your children? who owns your body? Do you or does the state? And so I believe that I call this the tip of the spear in the culture wars. It's about power, you know? And when you look at what used to be country by country vaccination infrastructures, you're now seeing the emergence of a world vaccination infrastructure. And that is dominated by the World Health Organization, which this year put vaccine hesitancy as one of the top 10 threats to global health, which really kicked off the assault in this country this year on the personal belief vaccine exemptions. It's the first time the World Health Organization ever put how you think as one of the top 10 threats to global health, rather than obesity or the opioid crisis or chronic disease or whatever, or malaria. No, it was you being hesitant about the use of vaccines, an extraordinary departure. So you have a worldwide vaccination infrastructure where you have public-private business partnerships that have been developed between governments and the pharmaceutical industry, and also at the world level, at the global level, between the World Health Organization, the pharmaceutical companies, the biggest philanthropic organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and governments. And this is a multi-billion-dollar infrastructure. A tremendous amount of money is involved. And so if the World Health Organization and the governments have committed to eradicating disease through the forced use of vaccinations, then you're going to see these kinds of assaults on the legal right to exercise individual choice when it comes to vaccination, because they see vaccine hesitancy as a virus that's infecting people's clear thinking, in their view, because people are resisting having to use, in our country, it's 69 doses of 16 vaccines between the day of birth and age 18. With all the vaccines coming down the research pipeline, they cannot afford to have resistance. They must have compliance so that the companies can meet their stockholders' expectations, so the medical community doesn't have to deal honestly with vaccine failures and vaccine risks. And so this whole idea that some can be sacrificed for the rest, some individuals, that it's ethical to say, well, it's the price of doing business, it's the price of implementing a public health policy, is that some can be sacrificed for the rest. That utilitarian rationale is what underpinned Jacobson versus Massachusetts, the seminal Supreme Court decision in 1905 that said that, yes, states have the constitutional authority to require individuals to be vaccinated against smallpox. And from that point on, that idea that some can be sacrificed for the rest has underpinned public health policy in this country and indeed around the world. And so we have a choice to make in this country right now. Are we going to continue to walk down this road? Are we going to allow a utilitarian rationale that allows a minority of people, and we don't even know how big that minority is, to be sacrificed for the rest? That kind of thinking was at the Nuremberg doctor's trial at Nuremberg was considered to be a pseudoethic and not an appropriate philosophical underpinning for government policy. And I think that we really in this country need to have an open public discussion about it. But here's the thing: you've got congressmen and senators in Congress who this year have directed, as you pointed out, directed Google and Amazon and Facebook and the social media platforms to censor this conversation, to disappear and ghost websites like NBIC.org and NBICAdvocacy.org, where we try to help people communicate with their legislators on these topics. They have, when you have the government telling corporations that they have to engage in censorship, we are in a very, very dangerous situation. And I think, in my view, The way we stop this is we have to, it's hard work, but we have to elect people. And people have to run at the state level and the congressional, at the federal level, honest people who are going to protect our cultural values and beliefs, who are going to protect our freedom. Because that's the way this government is constructed. We can only change the laws if we change the people who pass the laws. The courts aren't going to save us, and I don't believe, and I don't believe that we're going to be able to really have the laws that we want unless we have people in place who are going to vote the right way.
Well said. Thank you. Professor Holland, what we're looking at now is a vaccine. I'm only taking one, Gardasil, and when we look at the science behind it, it is appalling that this was ever allowed to be produced, let alone mandated. Tell us the story of your concern and what the audience may not know about the Gardasil vaccine.
Sure. So Gardasil is one of the vaccines against the human papillomavirus, which in well over 90% of cases is, you know, benign. There's over 200 different types of these viruses, but, you know, over 20 years ago, scientists discovered that there was an association between these certain ones of these HPVs and cervical cancer. And so they thought, aha, you know, we could come up with a vaccine. And something that, you know, maybe not all your listeners know is, as we've sort of referred to, the vaccines in the United States in 1986 got unbelievable liability protection, and it was made even more complete by the Supreme Court in 2011. So you can't sue the manufacturer, or you can't sue the doctor who gives it to you once the federal government's recommended. So this is a liability-free product, de facto. So, but anyway, the clinical trials of Gardasil, it's very clear that they lied to the subjects. They told them that it was already safety tested when it wasn't. They told them that half of the people in the trials would get a placebo. They didn't. They got actually the aluminum adjuvant as the so-called placebo. It was a total false placebo. And, you know, young women and some men, you know, young women died in these trials and got severe permanent injuries. And because it appears as if these injuries were not properly categorized, they weren't properly reported from the clinical trials in a whole variety of different sleights of hand. You know, they were able to get it licensed by the FDA through a sort of a quickened process, and then they were able to get it recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and then start the whole global, you know, feeding frenzy, and it's now in over 125, 130 countries, and it's being pushed aggressively everywhere. It's already being mandated in two states in the U.S., Rhode Island and Virginia, and also the District of Columbia, although there's, for now, opt-outs there. But there's a bill in New York, for instance, to mandate this for children as young as 9 years old. There's bills in every state, virtually, to mandate the Gardasil vaccine, and there are known deaths. So, and what's remarkable, and people don't know this, this also didn't get into the media, so a young woman, Christina Tarcell, died after her third dose. She wasn't yet 21 years old, and her mother, Emily, fought for 8 years in the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program to demonstrate that it was the Gardasil that caused her daughter's heart arrhythmia and her death. And she showed that. She had to appeal it. It came back, but it was found that it was more likely than not that Gardasil caused Christina Tarcell's death. And the Department of Justice, on behalf of HHS, did not appeal that decision, Gary. The DOJ and HHS knew that if they were to appeal that decision to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, they would likely lose. And they decided that that was a bad idea. So they didn't appeal it, but it's been found by a very biased U.S. court that Gardasil can cause death in young adults. And yet, you know, it's now licensed for adults up to 45. It narrowly escaped being recommended on a blanket basis to adults, men and women. And it's a fraud. It really is a fraud. The clinical trials were fraudulent, and there's a lawsuit in California right now that's going forward alleging fraud on Merck's behalf. There's lawsuits in Colombia. There's lawsuits in Japan. There are many countries that have lawyers on behalf of many people who've been injured by this particular vaccine that's being aggressively marketed everywhere.
Thank you. Dr. Sutton, I'd like you to share a little more of your experience as a practicing physician in California now, since you are facing the most draconian laws in the nation sponsored by State Senator Richard Pan. How are these vaccine bills now changing the medical profession? You mentioned earlier that's creating fear, but you should be commended for your courage because you're still offering the parents some measure of protection.
Been very fortunate in California to have an organization that is about 3 years old named Physicians for Informed Consent. And that is an educational group that allows us physicians to have a forum and to have access to an attorney who's readily available and deeply understanding the variations of interpretation of the California law. We've also experienced that the schools and some of the HMO groups of doctors have acted as snitches on doctors and turned over exemptions that really are confidential medical records. Also, the Department of Health has advised school officials that if they see a medical exemption that, quote, looks suspicious, end quote, they should not honor it. So people are acting as though 276 has already passed, even though 277 is still the law. And in California, a doctor still can write a medical exemption according to a doctor's own discretion. So there's a lot of social divisiveness that's been the outcome of this legislation. That's part of Senator Richard Pan's legacy in the state of California, I'm sorry to say. And there's also, as always, a large amount of courage and people putting forward great effort and finding and developing new skills to learn how to begin to manage this effort at changing the people who pass the laws so that we can learn how to lobby, how to communicate when the media, mainstream media, doesn't want us to say anything. I've written letters to the Sacramento Bee twice that were not no response and no publication. And I've sent letters that other doctors have written and the same answer. So there's a huge suppression of the expression of other opinions, which would be the way that journalism should work, to give the population both sides of a story that's important to them. I think for myself, I feel sometimes a huge, huge heaviness of what faces families if this passes, because there's no question that there is enormous potential for damage from vaccines. And families will have to have a plan B so that they're not shocked if this law does pass. They have to say, okay, if worse comes to worse, I'm going to homeschool, I'm going to move, or I'm going to figure out how to start vaccines in such a spaced out way that I minimize the chance of side effects in my child. And that is heartbreaking to think about people facing, because we don't understand the vaccines we have. All the research money has been spent in development of new vaccines instead of understanding those we have. So we can begin as looking at vaccine injury risk to say what genetic factors, what family history factors, what personal history factors, and what new research can point to the areas of concern. There's the same year that 277 passed, Dr. Yehuda Schoenfeld edited and released a textbook on vaccines and autoimmunity. And that is not included in the CDC guidelines to support a medical exemption. So people with family history or personal history of autoimmune disease are not protected from receiving more of the vaccines, especially the aluminum-containing vaccines, that could trigger a new autoimmune disease in them, or aggravate a pre-existing autoimmune disease.
Dr. Sutton, unfortunately, we're out of time. I just want to add one quick thing to what all of you have said, and that is that we should not just be concerned about vaccines or the CDC's compliance with Big Pharma. It's a $60 billion a year industry. But I believe that we should go after the identification. We should be looking at how that happened. We're beginning to research that now. We expect to have an article written within a week to show it was purely financial and purely political, because the people who lobbied Ronald Reagan and his cabinet for this exemption all went to work within a short period of time within the pharmaceutical industry, including the very people, the vaccine makers, much like Judy Gerberding left the CDC to go over to Merck. So that when that story is told, then maybe we could get a groundswell of people around the United States to say, hold hearings and let's address this issue and hopefully put pressure on our legislators to rescind it. In any case, I want to thank you, Dr. Sutton and Mary Holland and Barbara Lou Fisher, for coming on and sharing your points of view. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.